HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the HR HQ podcast. My name is Andrea Hayes and today I'm joined by Sandra Healy, CEO and founder of Inclusio. Sandra, you're very welcome.
Good morning. Delighted to be here, Andrea.
Well, we're delighted to have your expertise with us this morning. And I might start by asking you to give a brief overview of your current role and then also maybe how you got into the industry and your background.
Yeah, so I've quite a long CV, I would say, Andrea, but all of it has led me to here today. So I spent 20 years in the global telecoms industry. I then spun the idea for Inclusio into Dublin City University back in 2016. I studied psychology and organizational psychology in parallel to being an engineer in telecoms. And I set out in 2016 to address one of the biggest challenges I was experiencing and I was hearing from leaders around how do you measure culture? How do you measure culture and how do you know who you have in the organization? So I decided I was going to combine technology, psychology and ethical AI, as we describe it, to bring a scientific evidence-based approach to measuring people and culture. So 4 years in R&D, we spun Inclusio out of the university in 2020, and I brought on two co-founders. So there's myself and two co-founders, and we describe what we do in Inclusio as help companies measure, action, and report on their people and culture.
It's incredible, Sandra, you've redefined almost workplace culture, which we're going to delve into. But today we're looking at return to office and the trends. And as you're aware, HR professionals are continually adapting to new challenges and indeed opportunities around this. And I'm wondering, what's your opinion on all of the recent high profile companies across a wide range of industries who are looking at this? And what are the main reasons, do you think, for changing trends around return to office?
Yeah, it's been a hot topic, I would say, since COVID, because I think for all of us, I've heard some stats that we had accelerated the pace of change around hybrid working by 20 years because we didn't have a choice when we went into COVID lockdown. And it was interesting. I was at an event in London a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about how flexible working is a privilege. It's something that should be earned, which I thought was quite an interesting perspective, right? And I think, it had me thinking that that's probably driving a lot of the conversation and the narrative around it from a leader's perspective, right? In that, okay, we didn't have a choice back then, but we have a choice now. And we've had the time to understand the pros and cons of it from our company perspective. And I think, certainly what I find in some of the debates around it is leaders, there's a fear that a lack of productivity, for example, that it may potentially be impacting innovation. And, you know, I think what we're starting to see now is definitely over the last 12, maybe 15 months, is that trend of some of the large companies saying, right, that's it, we want everybody back, you know. And it's quite emotive, really, because a lot of people have now built their lives and their families, and that work and life balance piece is built around their working arrangements, you know, so it's very tough.
There's so much there, Sandra, I want to delve into, but I'm really interested in your use of words around choice and privilege. And right, then the whole concept, I suppose, of organizations trying to handle that pushback or potential pushback or resistance now, as you mentioned, employees have set a lifestyle out based on what they were used to. So how can organizations kind of get that good balance in the return to office policy and maybe start looking at, you know, privilege and choice and some of the things you mentioned there?
Yeah, I do. Like, you know, I always think, if I think about my work in DEI, right, over the last 20 years, I've always described it, I used to describe it as policies and practice and hearts and minds. Now I describe it as data and evidence, right, because that's the work that we do. And I certainly find that that drives change, right? So if we think about all of those things, it's remarkable that quite a lot of companies still do not have detailed kind of transparent policies and practices laid out around hybrid working. Okay, so that's something that we need to look at, right? That's how you get things done and you make sure that it's fair and equitable for everybody. So that's the first thing. And then the hearts and minds piece, right? I think You know, we've five generations in the workforce now. It makes things much more complex. And to that point, Andrea, you have people who set their lives up around work and get the job done. So it's there has to be that interaction and listening, right? And having being able to have a conversation around, you know, productivity and outputs and how do we get the job done, but at the same time, still be able to have the flexibility that I need to run my life, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's complex, but I, just to the other point then I was making around evidence. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I'm seeing there's a lot of emerging research that's kind of contrary. some saying, oh yeah, there is an impact on, we can see that there's an impact on productivity. Others say, no, there isn't, you know. So I think it's quite confusing for leaders. And I think in the absence of kind of clear direction, I think there's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction going on of, right, that's it. Get you all back in, everybody back in, because it mm-hmm. used to work then. And I think that there potentially is somewhere in the middle. And just to say, there's lots of case studies out there of organizations who've been doing this for years and have done it really well. So, you know, I'll leave it at that. But I think we're probably at the start of trying to figure this out, I would say.
And as you're talking, and I'm hearing you talking about hearts and minds and data, and then installing new policies, a lot of this is beyond the remit, perhaps, of what would have been usual within companies. So you might need to engage with some expertise like yourself or other companies to really help you define what the policy is, because obviously you want to offer flexibility to employees who might still prefer remote or even the hybrid model, and then also look at the people who prefer being in the office. So there's kind of various spectrums there. There's other people that perhaps might want to be a global trotter and work around the world. So there's a lot to take in and a lot of hearts and minds and data all to be kind of dissected down. It's a tough challenge.
Yeah, I think, and I think it's even more complex than that, right? In that I think the first thing companies need to look at is who can do it and who can't, right? Because there's some jobs, for example, that you just don't have that choice, right? That there isn't an option around flexibility. So that would be the first thing I would say is, you know, really take a hard look across the organization, across the roles and say, okay, well, where can we realistically apply this and not? And be really upfront about that. So when you're hiring, for example, into those departments that you can't offer that flexibility for whatever reason, that you're crystal clear that that's the way it is. Where lots of really good case studies and examples around this concept of output, so a focus on output and results-only work environments, for example. And if you think about the nature of how work is moving towards more kind of project work, you know, where you have a beginning and an end of the work that you're doing, portfolio type roles and jobs within organizations. Is it really the right thing to be doing, you know, asking somebody to sit in a car or get a train for a couple of hours a day or 4 hours a day or whatever, to do a job that they could do just as well from their home office? Okay, so it, and that's complex, right? Because it's how do we get the work done? How do we know the work is being done? How do we know the productivity is at the same level or in some cases higher than we would get if we had everybody in the office? How do we know that and guarantee that? And how do we keep the wheels on the bus, essentially? And I think people managers are a key component of it, right? Because it's much more complex as a people manager to be able to manage individuals and manage remote teams and people who are working flexibly. So I would say that's a key part that employers need to think about. How do I make sure that my people managers have the skills and are equipped to get the best out of their teams and keep things moving?
And as you mentioned there, Sandra, people managers, I'm wondering, you know, is there a new area around what strategies are effective for ensuring equitable opportunities for people managers to offer them to remote, hybrid and on-site employees? Because maybe that's a new dynamic that people haven't really had to deal with before.
Yeah, I think it, like I was listening to a podcast a couple of days ago and they were talking about, you know, what's going to happen around AI and how it's deployed in companies throughout this decade. And it was talking about how people are going to have to become managers and part of what they manage will be the AI, which I thought was very interesting, right? Mm. It's almost like they'll have AI employees, right? So, but if you think about how you would apply new technologies into a team, as the manager of that team, you're going to have to figure out, well, how do we keep the job going, keep to work, keep productivity going, keep innovation going, make sure levels of psychological safety, so that's, you know, being able to speak up and have my ideas heard around the table, make sure the well-being is good around the team, make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing as a manager, checking in with people. And also, this is the individualized piece, making sure that I understand the nuances of what's happening for the people in my team. You know, and these are real examples. You know, somebody training for a marathon might say, look, I'd like to go and do my training in the morning. Is it okay if I clock on at 9:30, for example? You might have somebody else saying, well, look, you know, a guy saying, well, I want to pick up the kids at 4:30. Is it okay if I, you know, I'd like to work in this and I'll check back in at 5:30, you know? Like, as a manager, really the focus can be on how do I get the work done? How do I keep the team connected, keep productivity high, deliver for what the company has asked us to do as a team, and at the same time, give my people what they need so that they become part of this future success of the organization.
And optimizing productivity for companies now is sort of taking a new lens, because you're looking, as you mentioned, the people managers and really trying to help people have that work-life balance, you know. And this perhaps is conversations that we wouldn't have had a decade ago, because you just went in, you're 9 to 5 and you had your holidays, and maybe there was the odd time that you might have to leave early to collect the kids or a special event. But now it seems to be an ongoing conversation to optimize productivity, but also to make sure that the workforce culture is correct.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that you mentioned that, Andre, because if you think about it, like a lot of our workforce structures and even our working patterns are built, like come from the 1950s, where we had one person went to work and the other person stayed at home. And that's just not the way of the world now. So all of this, you know, the 9 to 5, the expectation that you're in the office, or unfortunately in some careers, you're having to do 70 hours. And if you're not seen to do that, well, you're not going to get promoted in certain professions, you know. Like, those are the kind of things that we need to reflect on and change. You know, when was the last time we looked at this? Like, it really, if you think about, take a step back as a leader or CEO and go, okay, we need to get the work done. We want to build a sustainable organization that endures, is fit for the future, and is, you know, it has return on investment for our employees, our shareholders, our investors. And then it's the recognition that none of that happens without people. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we have to think about, okay, we probably have 5 generations here. We have different people with different demands. How can we create an environment and a culture where we get the best out of our people and we support them in as much as we possibly can while still getting the work done and keeping productivity high?
And that seems like a big ask, just to really redefine that workplace culture when you have people that have very different experiences of work. There could be somebody that's, you know, a couple of years in a business where they're used to the 9 to 5. There's somebody just entering into the business where this, all they know is hybrid and flexibility. So to get that employee engagement, to have a strong company culture, what sort of models should companies be looking at? Or do they need to kind of be looking at experts to come in and help them redefine their culture?
Yeah, so that's something that we did as part of our research in the university, is looking at how do you measure culture? Because in the conversations I was having with CEOs at the time, they were saying, look, culture is just not on my radar. I can't measure it. If I can't measure it, it's not going to be one of my top 3 things that I focus on. So part of the research and the work that we did was to define and develop and standardize a model around culture. And the components, we're 8 years at this now, and it's been standardized over the last 3 years. And the components that we look at are trust. So levels of trust at a leadership level, manager level, trust within my team, psychological safety, which includes speak up culture. It includes innovation. Are my ideas heard around the table? It includes well-being. So this is something we're talking about here. Okay, do I have everything I need to do my job well? It also looks at job supports. So do I have the right level of interaction with my manager? Do I feel like I'm part of the success of the organization? Am I going to stay here? And then the ultimate is belonging, right? And we published a paper there recently around how belonging is the new engagement. Because if you can create the conditions where people feel like they belong, there, an output of that is high levels of engagement and productivity. And just interesting, just one thing to pick up on that you said, and I think we haven't figured this out yet, is young people, for example, and I'm saying young people being very general there, right? But people coming into the workforce for the first time, that's a big question mark, right? Around, I'm coming into work, not physically coming into work, hypothetically coming into work because I'm in a hybrid environment. I'm not learning from the others around me. So that tacit knowledge that you pick up and learn, I wonder, is it going to have a negative impact on those individuals because they haven't had the opportunity to build like political capital and social capital, okay? And if we think about, you know, what political capital, that's kind of how do we do things around here? How do you get stuff done, you know? And the social capital then is around, you know, get working, getting other teams to work for you and to get you what you need. So it's quite complex and we don't know what the impact it's going to be on people's careers until we start to see this play out. And I think that that's driving a bit of the fear as well from a leadership perspective is for that particular cohort of people.
And as you're talking there, I'm even thinking of client capital, because maybe if you haven't had an opportunity to physically meet the client and to interact with whoever your clients are, then it might go to people who've had a longer history with people and probably know them on a more intimate way because they've met them face to face as such. So there's so many different areas to think about. And as you're talking and we're looking at kind of that mental health and belonging piece, I'm wondering, how do you balance the requirement for high performance, but also trying to really support your employees if you haven't met them and maybe they are remotely working?
Yeah, I think like this, like we would work with companies, for example, that just the nature of their business, like for example, in aviation and other sectors, right, where you have like potentially a small team that are distributed because that's just the nature of the business. And for a lot of those organizations, it could be only once a year that they meet and they don't have a choice really, or because that's just the nature of their work and they get the job done. Okay. And that's not to say that that's the ideal, right? But they don't have a choice. They have to figure it out. I think one of the things I heard early on was around, you know, don't be bringing people into the office to do exactly the same thing they could be doing at home.
Yeah.
And I think we need to pay attention to that. Because you're going to create frustration and you're certainly not going to get, you know, high productivity with that kind of thing. So we need to figure out, okay, if we want to get, you know, we want to keep the innovation, we want the tacit knowledge to happen, we want people to interact, and yet we want to create flexibility. So how do those things coexist? I would say if you're going to be bringing people in or teams in or whenever, that there's things set up for people to interact when they're in. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I can give you an example. Even in, like, we're a small team, right? And we have people in all different parts of the world. When we can get together, we get together. And it's structured coming together. So, for example, we would have our design and our tech team meeting with our customer success and delivery team. Mm-hmm. Because when you bring them together, they hear the whole cycle end to end of what's going on from a customer perspective. And then the others are able to bring that back into their team and say, right, from an innovation perspective and a product roadmap, these are the things we need to be thinking of. So, you know, could that be done online? Possibly. But there's, as you say, Andrea, you know, that connection, human connection, the innovation, when you have that together in a room, I think certainly from our perspective, it's much more efficient and we get more done in a couple of hours than we would if we were online.
I know, and I think there's something about spontaneity, human interaction and the innovation piece that, you know, AI doesn't have that because you ask it for a specific question perhaps or task and it gives it a specific answer. Again, if you're working remotely, there isn't that interaction. But I notice, particularly around creative fields and actually I think all problem solving in any business, when there's that human interaction, there's those moments of spontaneity. And sometimes they're the breakthrough moments where everybody collaborating together, that kind of big picture moment and those aha moments. And I really feel that that's the little piece that often you're getting when you are creating a culture where people are joined together in the office.
Yeah, and I was reading a paper the other day, actually, and I'll share it with you because I thought it was very interesting. It was talking about how With online, we tend to stay within our demographic groups. Isn't that interesting? Okay. So that when we're, you know, pinging our colleagues or having a side chat or whatever, we tend to stay within our groups. And I'm not surprised to hear that, right? People like themselves. That's human nature. We're pattern machines. But if you go back to that point around innovation, right? You know, when you put a diverse team in a room and you have high levels of psychological safety where everybody can speak up and innovate, you get 10 times the amount of ideas and innovation and problem solving happening within that room. Where you don't get that, this is what this piece of research is saying, is that that's we're losing that, right? Because the interactions are happening within the same demographic groups.
It is fascinating. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that can be overlooked, but it could give you that competitive edge, you know, that sort of way, if you just look in terms of the mix of people.
Yeah. And I think I spent 5 years in the university, and I remember it was the master's students and the international master's students. And I think what they realized, I remember one of the academics telling me what they realized was that when they said to people, oh, get into groups of five, you're going to work on this project. When they said to the students naturally got into their own demographic groups, right? And then they decided then, you know what, we're not going to allow that to happen. What we're going to do now is we're going to assign people groups. And then it just became the norm. And they said the difference in just even the relationships that got forged throughout the 2 years. Isn't that interesting? So sometimes it's the same kind of thing, right? Is that, and what they did was by the lecturer saying, you know, these are your group assigned groups, that's creating psychological safety. You know, that's saying, okay, this is the group you're going to work in. This is the task at hand. And we're here if you need us. Like, there's no reason why we couldn't be applying those type of principles in work. But it's just, that's the first time I've actually seen a paper coming out to say that online, that is actually driving us towards our own groups. I hadn't seen that before. So I'll be following that thread with interest.
And Sandra, it's great to have the research to kind of map out best practice around workplace kind of innovation and just creating culture. So it's a constantly changing area, and I'm sure it will continue to evolve. But one of the things, I suppose, for many people is that whole staff retention piece and creating attractive career paths. Like, what are the specific ways that we can attract top talent? And you mentioned your own team are spread wide and far. Is that a new lens that we're not, say, if you're based in a city, you're just looking at people based in the city, you're kind of able to widen your pool and maybe attract people that you wouldn't have previously thought you could?
Yeah. And like, that's not a phenomenon that's just now, right? I remember speaking to one of the big tech companies years ago in Dublin, and they were saying that it was really difficult for them to hire senior women and attract them into the business in Ireland. And they said to me that, you know, the challenge we have is that when we reach out to women and say, look, we've this senior role, we'd like you to come and, you know, talk to us about it, that the women quite often were reluctant to have that conversation with them. And what they realized is because women can't just say, oh, yeah, of course, let's talk about salary and how this works. Women had to consider, well, what do we do about schools? And who's going to look after the parents? And what are we going to do about the home? And all they realized that there was all of these other things that needed to be taken into consideration before a senior woman could consider picking up her life and moving to another role. And quite often, a lot, it's not something that when they reached out and tapped a man on the shoulder that he had to think about. Isn't that quite interesting? So they had to take a very different approach to how do I go and have this conversation about this high potential talent that I want to bring into my organization. I would say that applies at all levels, because if you're going to take it, it costs 6 to 9 months salary to replace a person who's left your organization. Like, so if you think about that, you know, if you don't want to create a revolving door because you haven't paid attention to your culture. So, you know, you're right, culture, like we measure culture scientifically, we benchmark it, it's all based on the voice of your people. And we're able to give you pinpoint nuances around how each group are feeling and what's working for them and what's not. And are your managers doing a good job? All of that, right? But that's the kind of level that you need to be at now. It's complex. As I said, you've 5 generations, you have a lot of diversity, you have different needs, and you really need to know at that level what's going on for people.
And I suppose, as you mentioned, it's very complex and nuanced. But if you know at that level what's really going on with your people, it's a great way to plan for the future and really manage the productivity and really manage the output while keeping everybody happy within the kind of frame of culture. So it's so important for the overall success of every business now.
It is. And like, we would have customers that stopped hiring in particular locations because we were able to produce the evidence for them that, you know, the culture is not where it needs to be. And now we understand why people aren't staying, you know. And like, for me, I'm very much a show me the evidence person, right? And I think what I'm finding is, thankfully, right, 8 years of my life and our lives as a team bringing this solution to the market, what I'm finding is when I bring Inclusio data insights into a leadership team or a board, there's no resistance, right? I'm bringing them in evidence, scientific evidence, and the voice of their people. And we move very quickly into a discussion going, okay, what do we need to do? What's your recommendation? What's next? Like, in all my 20 years of working in DEI and people and culture, I've never had that response. So it just shows me that, you know, what some leaders need, not all of them, right? Some leaders, it's greater good and whatever. No, majority of leaders, they want evidence, they want solutions, and they want credible scientific insights that are going to be able to help them make data-driven decisions.
So I'll leave you with this question then, based on the evidence that you have kind of garnered, what are the long-term plans for remote and kind of, I suppose, work office balance based on the evidence that you're seeing and your own lived experience?
I think it will remain complex. Okay. And I think, like, one of the examples I've talked about for many years is Barclays Bank introduced a concept called dynamic working many years ago. And one of the things they did was mapped out the different job roles across the organization and had transparent and open conversations around with their employees around, okay, this is how we're going to get the work done. And at the same time, give you the flexibility around your work and your life balance. I think we need to move to those type of adult discussions and conversations. Is it complex? Yes, it is. Will it apply to every role? Probably not. Does it apply to a lot of roles? I think yes. And I do think as companies start to adopt and embed more kind of technology, particularly around AI, I do think we're going to see more careers and job roles moving to project-based. And if you can do that, it's very easy to measure outputs. So, you know, that's the future. I think that's where we're heading, probably quicker than we think.
And as you're talking, Sandra, and I know you mentioned that paper that you'll share and we'll put it up on HRHQ, but there's so much more to this conversation that I want to continue on with. So perhaps we might have to get you back in again with another lens. But for anybody who maybe wants to connect with you and look at some of the research and the wealth of experience you have, you might give out your details to our listeners.
Yeah, sure. No problem. So you'll always find me on LinkedIn and inclusio.io. So that's inclusio.io. And we have a lot of papers up there. We've newsletters. Please connect with us. For me, we have an academic paper coming out around neurodivergent individuals and how they're experiencing the workforce. We're working on that with Ulster University and Stanford University. So what I would say is find us online, connect with us, and you'll see our publications then as we're coming out. And if you'd like to see how the platform works, we're very proud of it. We've gamified data capture, so please just get in touch and be happy to show you how it works.
Sandra Healy from inclusio.io, thank you very much for talking to us on HRHQ this morning.
Thank you. Thanks, Sandra.
HRHQ.ie, the podcast.